and welcome to Blogosphere, Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley, and I'm the founder of Blogosphere. We run events, a magazine, an influencer network, and now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, please do drop me an email at alice@blogospheremagazine.com. We're delighted to announce that Series 3 of Serious Influence has an exclusive sponsor, the music licensing platform, Licked. Licked provide commercial music from real labels for licensing into creators' content. It means that you can have great music on your videos without the fear of copyright claims or losing ad revenue. If you want to learn more about how you can legally use the music you love, be sure to check out Licked's website, licked.co. That's L-I-C-K-D.co. Today on Blogosphere Serious Influence, I'm joined by influencer Sam Chapman of Pixie Woo and Phil Hughes, who is the COO of Gleam. Both Sam and Phil have been involved in the influencer space for more than a decade and have first-hand experience of brand deals, contracts, licensing, and rights.
I'm Sam Chapman, part of Pixie Woo, which is makeup blogging that I do with my sister, who can't be here today, I'm afraid, because she's at a charity event. And we have been online since 2008, uploaded our first video on YouTube, October 2008. So that's 11 years.
So my name is Phil Hughes. I'm the COO of Gleam Futures. I've had a strange career to date in that I started in media working for an agency, doing planning and buying and communications plannings and things like that. And then I became a media and entertainment lawyer. So I retrained in media and entertainment law, and I kind of specialised in working with talent, content creators, digital distribution and things like that. And then I started working at Gleam Futures. My role now is to set the strategy for the business kind of in a forward-looking way and making sure it's equipped to do what it needs to do.
And Sam, how did you first stumble into the world of social media? What were you sort of doing before?
I've been a makeup artist since, oh my gosh, my aunt is a makeup artist, so I've always done it. And when I was pregnant, I couldn't do it anymore. I just went on maternity and I started uploading videos online just to keep me busy. That's how it kind of took off. I didn't know it was a thing. It became a thing. Suddenly people were asking me for videos and I thought, yeah, all right, I'll carry on.
And what was the first sort of brand deal that you got? I mean, Serious Influence is all about the business side. So when were you first approached and realized that this hobby could actually be monetized?
Right. Okay. Let me think. Dom, was it Avon? Got the thumbs up, got it right. Okay, so our first ever paid job was with Avon, which was a really huge job at the time, and it involved me dyeing my hair three different colours. I know, I would never agree to it now, ever. Three different colours in the space of, I think, 6 months? Yeah, red, black, and blonde.
And was that across YouTube at that
time? It was across YouTube. I don't think I was on, maybe it was on Instagram as well.
Yeah.
But that what was your favourite hair colour?
Red. Was it interviewing each other?
It was stressful, put it that way.
Did you have any sort of security in line if it did go? I think Draco Malfoy's hair was insured in Harry Potter.
Was it? No. Yeah. Back in those days, we didn't have anything like that. Absolutely not.
And Phil, were you at Gleam at that time? And did you work on the sort of legalities of that?
Not that deal, no. So I joined Gleam around 2014-ish. Dom, the CEO and founder, and I knew each other in a previous life, in our media life. And I kind of ran into him after I'd become a lawyer. And he said, oh, I need a lawyer. So I became his lawyer for the business. We worked together a lot on the strategy for his business. And then eventually I became into the business when there was about five or so people in it. So I left law to do that. So I wasn't working on those deals, but I was advising Dom at that time on a lot of the deals that talent were doing in a really new space, and contracts that hadn't been done in the form that they were being done before.
So are you sort of pioneering the first talent creator contracts, would you say? And how different was that from what you were working in before?
It was different and the same, if that makes sense. So we were I mean, Gleam Futures did the first MCN contracts in Europe, I think. And we did probably a lot of the first brand deals and the first publishing deals. So we did spend a lot of time pioneering how those contracts were done for a different form of talent.
So I was just going to say, MCN, multi-channel network. What did that consist of, signing deals with that? How could you give it a bit of an explainer on an MCN for those in the audience?
Yeah, so at that time, multi-channel networks were taking talent into their network and essentially getting the right to represent their advertising and to sell their advertising space and to bring them brand deals. So it was questions around whether they should be allowed to do that exclusively, whether the talent should be able to do that themselves, whether the management company should be able to do that. And all the time with those contracts, as with most talent contracts, you're trying to think about what the talent is going to be doing in the future and what really matters to them, so as to be able to ensure that they can fulfill their potential over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years going forward. But the multi-channel network contracts were MCN saying, we want to be able to sell your display advertising, so your YouTube channel advertising, to advertisers and pay you a share of it so that you could scale how you were earning income on those channels.
And Sam, had you joined an MCN before being represented by Gleam?
Had I? No. I have to ask, because it was such a long time ago, and I've had kids since then, I just don't remember. The first one I remember being part of was Style Hall, and I think that was the only one we were ever part of.
Have the MCNs, on the whole, gone through a bit of a struggle, what with the advertising revenue on YouTube being hemorrhaging around Adpocalypse?
I think some of them have struggled. I mean, I think a lot of businesses in the digital economy have struggled over the last 5 years as it's scaled and it's become much more competitive. But multi-channel networks in particular, some of them have pivoted quite well to be able to go into talent. So they haven't started in talent management like Gleam did, but they've moved to management. Some of them attempted to move to become content producers, some with greater success than others, I think.
And Sam, have you had any sort of horror stories of being approached by brands? And when a brand, you know, has it evolved? Have people, do you think, on the whole, become more educated?
I think that we've been quite lucky in that every decision has to go past me and my sister. We both have to approve. So if we don't feel 100% about it, then it just doesn't happen. I think in the early days, maybe we had the odd one where people tried to put words in our mouths, and we're not good at that. So from really early on, part of our whole thing is, if it's scripted, we won't do it. We just will not get involved with anything that isn't authentic. If it's a product we didn't like, then that would be an automatic no anyway. But I definitely think there's been things that we'd agreed to that then ended up being scripted that we then pulled out of for that reason.
And you were able to pull out of that?
Yeah, because we wouldn't have signed anything until we knew exactly what it entailed and whether the brand partner that we were working with was on the same page as us. We need to know what the content is that they want us to make or that we want to make together before we sign anything.
And Phil, what stage do you actually look at the contracts? Does it go to, first of all, talent agents, and then they find things that, like, oh, this actually needs to go to Phil? Or do you oversee every single contract from the beginning?
I mean, personally, I don't look at them anymore. So we've got a legal team that I oversee that does that. But from a Gleam perspective, Sam's just alluded to it, there's quite a big gap, and there should be a big gap before you start looking at contracts. If a brand comes to you and the first thing they give you is a contract, that's not a great sign or a great starting point, because you should be talking about how you're both going to create authentic content together that will work for the talent's audience. But when they do come to us, yeah, we look at pretty much every contract for our talent.
How would you say that contracts have developed since your time at Gleam in terms of what brands are looking for? And I suppose that's to both of you.
It's actually quite an interesting question, because you did our Real Techniques contract, didn't you, before you were at Gleam?
Yes. Brand contracts, the best way that they developed, there's less of a fight to be had. In the early years of Gleam, when we were kind of pioneering the talent in the industry, there was a lot of conversation to re-educate brands, on, particularly with regards to things like intellectual property. So who was going to own the content to the end of it, and what could you do for it? And brands and agencies were very much treating it like a creative advert buy. So obviously when a brand goes to an agency, on the whole, they get to own the content that they use. but it's about educating them, then actually it's a completely different buy, and it's a completely different deal, and the talent needs to be in control of the content with you, brand, to make sure that it works for you and that it works for them and their audience. I mean, you're not going to own it and being able to do whatever you want with it at the end, because this is a talent deal, it's not just a media deal.
So in a contract, do you normally have something, say they want usage rights on that content for 6 months, a year, and that is an extra additional cost?
Yeah, I mean, all the deals vary, and some of them have a year's usage up front. The importance is in the detail of the usage, if you're agreeing to it, beyond the talent's channel. So the importance is, how long can they use it for? Where can they use it? Is it in the UK? Is it globally? What type of media can they use it for? Can they use it in retail? Do you get to approve those things? All of that, it kind of is detailed in the contract and very easy to get wrong.
And I also think that for deals that are long-term, you have to be aware that the landscape changes very quickly. So things that you have on the contract may be completely different or not exist in 5 years' time. So just being aware of that, like, you know, Vine or whatever, things move very fast.
I think what we see quite often are brands going onto Instagram and taking pictures, either reposting them sometimes without credit or using them in their branded newsletters to pushing product. Do Instagram own the copyright when it's on there? What's that?
It's very bad practice to do that. If I mention something and the brand contacts me and says, can I use this or repost it? I'm almost always absolutely fine with that. But it does cross a line when you're using it to advertise your products, and in which case that's why it's really good to have management, because they fight your battles. Go Phil.
Do you think that brands increasingly are looking for specific metrics when it comes to return on investment opposed to brand sentiment, and that you're looking at sort of more guarantees in contracts that are coming in 2019? And is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, that's a big question.
I know. I like asking big questions. You've come on Serious Influence.
I think it's a good thing that they're asking for it. What's less of a good thing is in the last 12 months where that has driven the market to. So I think it's absolutely right for brands to say, I want to know what results I'm going to get from this, whether it's views, engagements, click-throughs or whatever it is. But the starting point has to be the talent. It has to start with a talent lens, and it has to be talent focused. If you start from the media metrics, you get into a place where you're buying it on the basis of what you're going to achieve rather than the content. It has to be content first and talent first. And the concentration on data has unfortunately led us to a place where we've lost some of the quality and authenticity in the market. That being said, I think there's a massive opportunity, and I think one of the things that we'll see in the next 12 months of the market is a more intelligent combination of media with talent content. So you start with the talent and you start with the content and you make sure it's authentic and you make sure it's a high quality, and then you scale it through media spend, and that allows you the opportunity to deliver the performance metrics that the brand is looking for through both organic and paid for media. But starting with the media, unfortunately, I don't think is the right way to go.
Yeah, do you think that many people are wanting it to be a straight media buy now, and that is just not what this market is about? It's about humans and creativity, and it's just not A plus B equals C. And I don't know, Sam, what do you think? Happy medium?
I think, you know, there's people on both sides. There's people that understand it, and there's people that don't really understand it.
I think we're seeing a move away from it, though, from what we've seen anyway in our world. I think we're seeing less of a concentration on that approach.
What do you think of the influencer marketplace platforms?
They're kind of Takumis of the world and that kind of thing. I totally get why they're around, and I get why people bought into them. As the industry recognises influencer as an effective space for driving metrics and for communication, the natural instinct, therefore, is to scale your spend into the space and to spend more. And agencies, well, one way I can do that is I can put it through this platform at pace with one single buy. And it does a job. It absolutely does a job in terms of being able to buy a high volume of relatively small talent with a single brief. And it undeniably will deliver something for the brand, whether it's reach, engagement, or whatever it is. Our view, though, is that what you lose as a result of that is the quality of content and authenticity. And if you start with that rather than starting with the media, then you can turn it into scaled media and have improved effective results. But they do an awesome job, and they've got definitely got a role to play.
When you started, was it mainly brands, Gleam, like talent management, and you involved in those deals back in sort of 2008, 2009, when they first started happening? And we saw an influx of, and potentially the bigger agencies, WPP, Dentsu, but now we're seeing an increased amount of lean influencer-specific agencies. In your opinion, how many people have kind of joined the market, and does it make deals easier or harder? Are there sometimes email threads with a lot of people?
Well, I'm really lucky because I don't have to deal with any of that. And that's the one thing that I would say from this whole session. It's really important to have good management.
At what stage do you think that someone should look for management?
Well, when we got management, management didn't really exist for what we did. I just happened to bump into Dom in the YouTube messages. I started asking him questions and then asked him if he would manage us, because he knew more about money than I did, essentially. So Dom became our manager, and then Gleam happened.
What do you think are the other things of the kind of role of management? Yes, it's looking after the legalities, but is it sort of future-proofing and
all of these things? I mean, Nick and I, we solely concentrate on our content, and we do the yes or no's. So simply, Fran, our agent, will call us, and she'll be like, would you work with this brand, this brand, this brand, this has come in, yes, no, yes, no. And that's just kind of a top line, you know. And then she'll go back, then she'll come back with briefs, and then it's like, yes, no, definitely not. Do you see what I mean? So we are only really involved at the point where we're like, yes, we're happy to do that. No, we're not. Can you adjust this? See if they'll do that. Then it goes to contracts. So Nick and I, we don't have anything to do with that part of it. We just trust Gleam that they got it sewn up, and they always have.
What is the sort of best example of a brief that does come to you? What are the key points in it that are like, yes, they've got that? I know creative freedom you talked about, but
yeah, it's like, this is the product. How do you feel about the product? I love that product. I would buy that product myself. What a bonus that they want to pay me to promote their product. Okay, right, brilliant. So we're on the same page there. Then we'll go back with how we want to talk about it. And if that's a yes, then we go from there. Generally, Nick and I sort of work with them to create a brief that works for our audience and for us.
You talked a little bit earlier, you mentioned Real Techniques.
Yeah.
Could you talk a bit more about kind of that and the licensing, Phil, in general? I think in the last year we've seen sort of Makeup Revolution, Patricia Bright, Colourpop, Zoella collaborations, and how does that work? And if you are an influencer and you do really like a brand and want to collaborate, what are the things that you need to be looking out for?
I think there's a slight difference between a brand collaboration and a licensing deal. When you're talking about licensing, you're giving a third party rights to create a product, distribute it and market it and sell it, that uses your image, uses your name, and that kind of thing. And in return, you normally get paid what we call a royalty. So that'll be like a percentage of sales or a percentage of revenue or a percentage of profit, which is very important to get right. I always come back to, when we're talking to the teams about it, always come back to, what do the talent care about, and what do the brand care about, what do the third party care about? Talent can care about how their image is used, how long it's used for, where it's used, what it's used on. The quality of the product should be absolutely paramount, the match of the product, the ability to approve the products, to approve the marketing, all those things.
Do you normally get approval through on that then, because your face is being used to promote it, so you need to... Yeah.
I would never agree to do anything that didn't have approval if it had my face on it, ever.
Licensing deals, absolutely. To the point of that you can talk about approve where it's distributed, because something being distributed in Tesco is very different to being distributed in Selfridges, and in terms of how that reflects your talent brand is important as well. So approvals is key. But actually, beyond the contract, one of the most important things about licensing arrangements, they tend to be a bit longer term, so they might be 1 year, 5 year, 10 years, is that there are relationships they have to be worked at. Once the contract's done and dusted, which can take a while, licensing arrangements are partnerships, and you have to spend a lot of time with that person. and that company achieving things together. So if up front you think, actually, that's not someone I can work with, it's not about signing a contract and then you never see them again. You have to work at them, otherwise they do go wrong, I think.
Founding a business, as
a content creator, I think you have to be really aware that every time you sign up to something, you lose a little bit of your power, a little bit of your shine. So you have to think very carefully about the financials that are involved with signing up to that thing, because you can't then go on and do another thing that's very similar with a bigger brand. Do you see what I mean? So you have a limited amount that you can do. We're very lucky with Real Techniques because it was a 10-year thing, but that
was 10 years. Yeah.
It was, yeah. I mean, well, yeah, it's actually longer than that now. I think it's 11, but.
Yeah, you guys have worked together for a while, haven't you?
Yeah,
well, really I suppose you're getting the guaranteed, well, is it guaranteed income if it's on a revenue split? Like, there's obviously going to be money coming in over a long period of time, but maybe you've compromised being able to get other deals and actually you could have brought in more revenue personally had you not have had that deal.
For sure. I think you have to look at what the potential is over a long period of time and find out how long that is. Sometimes people think, cool, I'm only signed for this for 6 months, so, you know, I can do something else. But actually, is that necessarily good? Because how many of those 6 months things can you do before your audience just don't want to listen to what you say anymore? So if you can get something that's longer term, but on one product that you're really passionate about, then it probably is going to pay off better. And also thinking about distribution, you know, a small online distributor may not be as good as, you know, much bigger. So there are lots of things to factor in before you just sign away exclusivity with one brand, I think.
Do you think that we are in a stage of ad fatigue now in terms of influencers doing so many ads on the whole?
Do you? You probably don't.
So
I do.
In which way the longer term partnerships are better because it's more authentic, but yeah, you're tired of seeing too many ads. Is it predominantly on Instagram?
I mean, Instagram is quite a big one for that. I try and do very few ads. It's very boring when it's continuously ad, hashtag ad, I think. And I feel like audience are so savvy to it and actually kind of cynical about it as well now. So yeah, I do.
There is an influx into the market of brand spend, but I think that, again, what we talked about earlier, the importance of authenticity, the talent believing in the product, the talent wanting to promote the product and creating an authentic story with that product cuts out ad fatigue, because it should be additive to the content rather than subtracting from the content, or at least equal to the content the talent's creating. And that's the big challenge, and you have to work with people who have experience of doing that.
Because people do like good ads. I think what happened with sort of digital, we just got bombarded with them. You know, you open a magazine, plug, and there's a nice looking ad, you're going to engage with that, or a really good video, and it actually can work really well.
Absolutely, yeah.
Do you think one of the reasons people are having ad fatigue is because of the ASA guidelines saying that you have to pretty much label everything as an ad?
I think the ad thing is good. If you're being paid to talk about something, then I think everybody should know. The gifting thing makes it really awkward because nobody knows what that means now. You know, essentially, everything has to have gifted, so it means nothing. That's where it gets confusing for me. I think it's really important if you're on holiday somewhere and you've been gifted that, then yeah, but just having hashtag gifted, it doesn't say enough.
Is it a bit frustrating that the regulations don't seem to also, like the press don't have to abide by the same sort of regulations as influencers? Do you think we've gone in just a bit hard?
I think that's true. I mean, I'm not really bothered by that particularly, but I can see why a lot of people would. I think that maybe, you know, I'm not sure the same restrictions are on Made in Chelsea people or reality TV stars. You know, I still see a lot of stuff on there, a lot of content where I'm like, hang on, that does look very suspicious. But I think that people are very hot on influencers.
Phil, what are your biggest frustrations about the industry?
I'm glad you said about the industry, because my life's just generally frustrating. could take a while. Frustrations about the industry. If I'm honest, I don't find that much frustrating about it. I kind of view most of the change that happens in the industry as an opportunity. And that's what attracted to me in the first place, is that it all happens so fast. The lack of consistency in the disclosure space is frustrating. If you're someone who is taking a gold standard belt and braces approach and you see people not doing that in the market, that can be frustrating, both for us and for the talent, even more so for the talent, I imagine. That's a bit of a frustration. There's frustrations that are still good, like the kind of growth of the industry and the bigger budgets is a good thing, but it means everything slowed down a little bit and it feels a little bit less entrepreneurial.
But do you think that although there are bigger budgets, there are more people in the supply chain, so you actually aren't ending up with a bigger budget necessarily for the talent?
In the brand space, maybe some talent. I don't think, only speaking for Gleam talent, no, I don't think it affects their budgets because we know what price we want to get. And I think a lot of the agencies we work with might take their margin from the brand rather than the talent, sometimes transparently, sometimes not transparently.
Sam, what are your biggest frustrations with the space at the moment? And then we'll leave on a positive note.
Do you know what? I don't feel like I have that many because I've kind of stepped away from it in my personal life quite a lot. God, this sounds really awful, but because Nick and I started so early on, I feel like we don't always have to go through all those extra steps anymore. So we're able to kind of sit back. And also because we have the luxury of such an incredible brand partnership with Real Techniques, I'm not the best person to ask that.
What would your advice be to somebody that wanted to start and go full time now?
I would say pick a subject that you know a lot about, that you're really passionate about. I think that online is very into people that are experts. So if you have an expertise in something, then you should capitalize on that.
I think that should actually be added into the value in pricing. We are doing a panel this afternoon about rates, but I heard recently from Amy Shearer, who will be here later, that actually credentials, expertise, then how long and what channel it's going to be on, and then how far that gets distributed is the whole value chain. It's not, I have this many followers and this many eyeballs. It's actually your personal credentials.
For sure. I think brands are much more excited about experts now. I'm not saying they're not excited about the millions of views, but they want to be in partnership with somebody that actually has experience and has that kind of knowledge.
And influence. Phil, predictions for the next year?
I think I mentioned it at the start, the approach of scaling content through effective paid media will be a big thing for brands in the brand space. We've talked a lot about licensing and product content, despite the amazing things that people like Sam and Nick have done. Actually, as an industry, we're only really scratching the surface in that space, and we're feeling a lot more product licensing and creation, brand creation opportunities coming through. So I think we'll be concentrating a lot on that next year.
So you're feeling excited and optimistic?
Always.
I'm feeling really excited about it.
A big thanks to Sam and Phil for coming on the show.
You've been listening to Blogosphere, Serious Influence, with me, Alice Audley. Join us next week for a brand new episode. Until then, be sure to check out blogosphere.magazine.com for more influencer industry updates. And why not invest in a subscription to our essential magazine whilst you're there?